This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thanks for joining us on our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And today we're going to start talking about railroads and bridges because, of course, the main streets of North Dakota were oftentimes right next to a railroad that was the real Main Street across North Dakota many years ago when we were being formed as a state. And today we're going to talk about one bridge in particular, and that is the one that goes over the Missouri River connecting Mandan and Bismarck. And we're going to talk about it with Mark Zimmerman. He's the president of the Friends of the Rail Bridge. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Doug.
And Emily Sackerson, who's a board member of Friends of the Rail Bridge and also represents Preserve North Dakota. And thank you for being with us, Emily.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with you, Mark. Why was the Friends of the Rail Bridge formed?
Well, Doug, when Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad, in their efforts to construct a new bridge across the Missouri River at Bismarck and Mandan, they have a process in which they need to work with various federal agencies to obtain a permit. And in that process was to consult with what are called consulting parties. That's local groups, local government agencies. We're all called together to meet with the Coast Guard, Burlington Northern, Santa Fe Railway, another agency called the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation. They all came together since May of 2018, I believe, and we started meeting on a regular basis to work through this permitting process for BNSF to construct a new bridge. And FORB, Friends of the Rail Bridge, was formed by a wide variety of folks here in Bismarck that had an interest in the historic significance and the place of that bridge to the Bismarck-Mandan community. We formed a group to, again, be involved in this permitting process. I think, Doug, I'd like to make sure that folks know we're not against BNSF building a new bridge. We want to make that clear to the listeners. We're here to be part of this process, this permitting process with the Coast Guard. Whatever that final decision will be on the Coast Guard, Friends of the Rail Bridge is there to have input to be part of that process.
Well, Emily, one of the resources I looked at when I was preparing for this interview was a story in the Bismarck Tribune at the end of May where your mother was cited, the Amy Sackerson, who is a regional advisor for the National Trust for Historic Preservation. You're a board member of this Friends of the Rail Bridge group. What makes this bridge suitable for historic preservation?
I would argue that this bridge is probably the most significant structure on the Northern Plains, not just here in Bismarck-Mandan or in North Dakota. Profoundly significant structure. The National Park Service says that historic places have powerful and evocative stories that they tell, that they're witnesses to the past, and place can really make connections across time. They create an empathetic understanding of what happened and why it happened. That's the value of all historic places. And, of course, this historic place embodies so many of the complex themes in Western history, in our history, our regional history, in our nation's history, opportunities for immigrants, economic development of the West, connecting the continent, connecting people, information, also displacing indigenous people. There are just so many themes that are all represented here in this particular bridge, as it was the linchpin in the completion of the Northern Pacific's Transcontinental Railway. I don't think that that significance can be understated.
Well, when the railroad was being built across the Northern Plains, of course, the Red River and Fargo and Moorhead was an important gap to fill, but nothing like the Missouri. And so give us a little bit of the history of the construction of this bridge, because that must have been a very significant undertaking.
Certainly was. This bridge was considered the wild and most difficult crossing to span. And this bridge, when it was built, this particular bridge, 1880, 1883, it was one of the biggest engineering challenges of the entire Transcontinental Railroad line. You think of them laying track across hundreds of thousands of miles, building tunnels, going through mountains. Well, this was just as much of an engineering challenge. And at the time of its completion, it was the largest steel bridge in the world. Steel was only just becoming used in bridge construction And most bridges before this were made of iron. This has a combination of steel and iron, but it was certainly the largest steel bridge in the world at the time of its completion. George Shattuck Morrison was the sort of self-made civil engineer who became the preeminent engineer of the time, and he was the one who was hired by the Northern Pacific to design and to oversee the construction of this bridge. He's known for having built a number of bridges across the Missouri River. This one is one of the few that remains, and it's probably the most intact. Construction began with an earthen dike, which you can see as you drive across from Bismarck to Mandan. You can see the earthen dike still today. The Missouri River was, of course, treacherous and wide and wild and prone to sandbars that move with changing currents and flows. And so Morrison actually had the foresight to think about the best possible crossings, and he chose where the current bridge is. He chose this because building an earthen dike would allow them to narrow the river to about 1,000 feet. Then they could finally span it.
Well, I did a little bit of research, and I found to my amazement that this particular bridge, which is almost 136 years old, was opened the same year as the Brooklyn Bridge, which is, of course, the centerpiece to the foot of New York City. Mark, how receptive has the BNSF Railroad been to your efforts to preserve the bridge?
Well, Doug, BNSF is, they want a new bridge. Their construction schedule calls for this bridge and others to be built. I would have to say it's been a work in progress. They've got what they want to do to build a new bridge. Again, I want to stay on the positive side and say, this is a process that continues to be discussed. We're not at the stage that, the final decision has been made. The Coast Guard has not made a decision on how this will go forward. They have not issued a permit. We still have consulting party meetings that involve the cities of Bismarck and Mandan, the state of North Dakota, the Department of Transportation, the State Water Commission. Many groups are still involved in the final decision. We'll have our input to the United States Coast Guard. Since the Missouri River is a navigable river, that's how the Coast Guard is involved. And this Advisory Council on Historic Preservation is there to assure that consideration is given to the significance, the historic significance of this bridge, Doug. So, again, BNSF certainly has their interests in it. We have had good discussions. We've had long discussions. Everyone submits information, and that process moves forward. I'd like to add, Doug, if I could, you mentioned about the rail bridge here in Bismarck-Mandan being the same age as the Brooklyn Bridge. When we had a celebration here earlier for the designation of the bridge as one of the 11 endangered sites in the United States, a comment was made that our bridge, or the bridge here at Bismarck-Mandan, is older than the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah.
when folks think of these unique landmarks around the world, and I don't want to get too far off the topic, but I don't think anybody would say take down the Brooklyn Bridge or dismantle the Eiffel Tower. And we want that consideration for our rail bridge.
Well, the Brooklyn Bridge and the Eiffel Tower require maintenance. So is there any estimation of what it would cost to maintain a bridge that the railroad isn't paying for it?
Doug, BNSF has had some cost estimates. They've not released all the figures. They have said on a couple of occasions that's proprietary information to the railroad, what they do expend on the maintenance of the bridge. But they have to file a report with the Public Service Commission here in North Dakota, and that report says the bridge continues to be in safe operating condition. So that's what we're going by. Yes, it will take continued maintenance, and our group, Friends of the Rail Bridge, is actively working with some possible philanthropic organizations that might be in support of our efforts to maintain the bridge, to keep the inspections going, to do that. We have a grant study underway, Doug, for the feasibility of the maintenance of the bridge, the feasibility of tying the bridge to the existing trails along the Missouri River with the Bismarck Park District. Again, there's a lot of moving parts still in this process that we were so thankful to Prairie Public Radio here to get the word out to folks to give them this, to give them an update on what's going on the bridge.
Well, have you had any connection with Warren Buffett? He's, after all, the guy who runs the holding company that owns BNSF, Berkshire Hathaway.
You know, Doug, we've joked about that yeah, does anybody know Mr. Mr. Buffett to get him up here? But again, I want to say, you know, BNSF has been, you know, very upfront. Again, you know, they've got their plans, and they need to work with all these consulting parties, just not Friends of the Rail Bridge, but they need to work with all of us as we work towards this permitting process and work through that. But we've had some great – since the bridge was nominated and selected as one of the 11 most endangered sites in the United States, that has opened some doors and some interest. And Emily, I think, has got a great insight on that's now more than just a Bismarck Mandan, and it's more than just a North Dakota thing now.
Well, does that mean, Emily, that the National Trust, that's an important word, trust, does that offer any financial support?
The National Trust has been involved in saving places for over 60 years. And this listing, this designation that the Bismarck Mandan Rail Bridge has recently received from that organization is a pretty powerful thing. It's a pretty powerful tool. It links places that are endangered or threatened by development or what have you. It links them to interest groups, possible funding sources, possible sponsors. And since Friends of the Rail Bridge is not going to be able to take over ownership of the bridge alone, any kind of solution that we would work toward would involve partners and other people. We need powerful players, and we need as many supporters as we can get. I think it's really interesting the amount of support that we've received, not just Friends of the Rail Bridge, but just this Section 106 consulting process has seen with the variety of consulting parties who've stepped up and requested to be involved in the decision-making process, in the conversations ongoing. It's local interest groups like us, like Preservation North Dakota, the ones that you'd think of, the Bismarck and Mandan Historical Societies, but also national interest groups, the National Trust, obviously, and then also the Historic Bridge Foundation, the Rails to Trails, and lots of tribes and local governments and state government entities all taking interest. It's just fascinating what this process can do and the kind of ideas that get brought together in this planning process for BNSF's permit.
Emily Sackerson is a board member. Mark Zimmerman is president of Friends of the Rail Bridge. Mark, what's the vision for this? If the bridge is preserved, what might it ultimately be used for? I mean, it's just people wouldn't just get on the bank and look at it, would they?
Doug, what we're looking at is a recreational aspect to it, that we could link it to trails on the Bismarck side as well as the Mandan side. There's a very cool, that's a good term, natural area on the Mandan side that was set aside from the construction of the Interstate 94. It has been left as a natural area on the Missouri River since that time. It's a popular area, and this bridge could link the Bismarck and Mandan communities via a trail. Another aspect of it is the education aspect. As Emily, put very well, this was a bridge. I joke, Doug, that this is a bridge that Theodore Roosevelt crossed to go to Medora, all the very first time he came to North Dakota and all the subsequent times that he came back to Medora, he crossed that bridge. And I've said, what if that bridge wouldn't have been there? Maybe Theodore Roosevelt would have went on a hunting trip in Wyoming and never came to North Dakota. But, so we're looking at the education. That's, a little bit on the light side. But Emily touched on a very important part. That bridge certainly, if I would say, sealed the fate of a lot of Native American peoples to the west. This was the linchpin to complete the construction of the Northern Pacific. That brought a whole new way of life to the Native Americans in that part of the country. My ancestors crossed that bridge to Homestead in southwest North Dakota. So that whole education aspect of what that bridge meant. And we've heard from people in this effort, Doug, that said, we got to remember that this rail bridge was, other than that and a ferry, were the only way people between Bismarck and Mandan could cross that river. So we've heard stories of young women and young men that would go either direction to a dance, and some met their future spouse by having that rail bridge to cross to get to a dance or a social event on the other side of the river. So that whole education aspect of the bridge, recreation is certainly a big part, but the recreation and education, we think, has some very significant aspects. I use when I'm in Minneapolis, I cross the Stone Arch Bridge in downtown Minneapolis, a great bridge that was turned into a pedestrian walkway and bikes, and it has, you know, the placards or the panels that tell the history of the milling and all of that in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area and the significance of that bridge. And we see that the same for our rail bridge, that it can certainly tell the story of the past and certainly link our communities to the future of our Bismarck-Mandan area.
Emily, the tracks in the right-of-way on either side of the river, this is located south of the I-94 bridge, would seem to dictate where a new bridge would go. So if BNSF builds a new bridge and this one is preserved, how close would these two structures be? And is that part of the issue the Coast Guard is concerned with?
Certainly one of their considerations. They have their three alternatives that they presented in order for their permit application to the Coast Guard. Among those would be the potential of a new bridge on a new alignment that would be 80 feet north of the existing historic bridge. So yes, if we were to find a solution that preserves the old bridge and allows for the new bridge to be constructed, they would be adjacent. But we've been looking at a number of organizations and a number of bridges across the country that have done similar things. If you've never heard of the Rails to Trails organization, you should definitely look them up. They're amazing. There are all sorts of examples of communities who have sought to repurpose either a railroad bridge or an interstate or highway bridge for pedestrian use, and it's successful, and there are precedent-setting examples of how to do it safely and efficiently and to reduce the visual intrusion of the new bridge and try to create the best way to experience an old bridge. That's something that people haven't been able to do in the same way in a long, long time. Nobody's actually been able to cross that bridge as a pedestrian or as a traveler on a passenger train in a long time. And one of the things that we think could be pretty exciting is if this were to be a pedestrian bicycle pathway, we'd have a whole new experience in Bismarck Mandan for people passing through, for people, you know, enjoying their community. It'd be an incredible asset and a new way to experience history and celebrate heritage.
Well, George mentioned the Stone Arch Bridge in Minneapolis over the Mississippi River, and that those two twin cities have actually taken a number of railroad right-of-ways and made them into bike paths and pedestrian paths. So let me ask this question. This is, at this point in time, how confident are you that this bridge, this 136-year-old structure, will be preserved?
I'm confident that we will find something that, you know, an end result that will celebrate the heritage of this bridge, whether or not it's a full restoration and conversion to the bridge. But I'd like to point out that part of this 106 consulting process, it's part of the National Historic Preservation Act. The aim, the requirement, is for the federal agency who's the permitting authority, so in this case the Coast Guard. They're required through this process to come to a solution that either avoids an adverse effect to the historic property, minimizes or reduces the effect to the historic property, or mitigates an adverse effect. And so no matter what, our community will see some outcome that celebrates and gives some respect to the heritage that could be lost, could be jeopardized, or it could just be minimized, you know, in the case of a preservation outcome.
Emily Sacrison is a board member of Friends of the Rail Bridge and also represents Preservation North Dakota. Mark Zimmerman is president of that group. Thank you both for being with us on Main Street today.
Thank you, Doug. Thanks for the opportunity to tell you about our bridge.
Thank you.
Coming up on Main Street, we'll talk about hemp. It's a new crop, but it faces some challenges. That story from Harvest Public Media.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Learn more at bushfoundation.org. Thank you.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Hemp. It's related to marijuana, but it won't get anyone high. The new farm bill included a provision to enable farmers to legally grow hemp for the first time in more than 80 years. But as Harvest Public Media's Madeline Beck reports, hemp faces some serious growing pains.
Soggy crops, seed fraud, and uncertainty. Those are only a few of the challenges facing the nation's blooming hemp industry.
I started getting questions like crazy. It was all over the place, my emails, my phone.
That's Philip Alberti with the University of Illinois Extension. Along with a handful of others, Illinois started licensing industrial hemp farming this year. More than 500 producers there are okayed to plant more than 13,000 acres. Hemp is a hardy plant, but Alberti says Midwest's torrential rains were brutal.
Hemp likes water, but it doesn't like wet feet. And, you know, this year has been, for the most part, you know, unprecedented.
Add to that faulty seeds. Farmers around the state have reported getting seeds that don't germinate well or aren't what they ordered. And those seeds can easily cost more than $10,000 a pound, generally shipped from Colorado, Canada, or Europe. If seeds all sprout, it can fetch a pretty penny as fibers for clothes or industrial materials, grains for food, or CBD, an oil popularized for many health benefits, proven or not. For hemp growers in Illinois, Alberti says,
I think it's safe to assume north than 90-95% of those applications were with the intent of doing it for CBD.
But while CBD's market has skyrocketed, it's hard to build an industry on a crop that hasn't been produced in the U.S. for decades. Hemp machinery and production facilities can be hard to come by. Take it from Jeff Whaling, chairman of the National Hemp Association, who helped legalize hemp growing.
There is no harvesting equipment. There isn't a huge seed supply. There is no decortication facilities, which are necessary components to tear this crop apart into its raw components.
He says there are small processors out there, but overall, Whaling cautions farmers to have a buyer before they risk everything on a crop that has insufficient insurance options, few bank and lending options, and no real guarantees.
I would hate to see farmers wanting to jump into hemp and there not be a marketplace. So, you know, be cautioned, buyer beware are words that I use continuously as we move forward.
Consider this. If a farmer grows hemp for CBD, they need female plants only, which produce CBD-infused flowers. If males come along, either from a mixed seed batch or from a neighboring hemp field, they'll pollinate the flower and ruin the crop.
Pollen from hemp can drift as far as 7, 10, some say as far as 20 miles.
And we don't know how certain hemp varieties behave in certain climates. If it makes too much THC, the plant will have to be destroyed. That's considered marijuana. So Whaling wants the U.S. Department of Agriculture to take several things into account while coming up with federal hemp rules expected next year. Like seed regulation, growing transparency, interstate commerce issues, banking issues. But some have already had luck. In western Illinois, there's a greenhouse with 90,000 hemp seedlings to be planted across a few nearby acres.
There's a strong possibility that you could grow somewhere between $20,000 and $55,000 an acre off of hemp.
That's Andy Houston. He's a sixth-generation farmer, and he's one of the few people in Illinois who grew hemp last year as a research test pilot. From that crop, he had seeds to sell this year, and he got experience to share with customers. He even bought his own CBD extraction machine to process in-house.
With the acres that we have, it should keep our oil extractor going for 12 months.
Of course, he's had to change how he does things. Like many others, he'd had to harvest it by hand last year. But he's trying a disc mower this year, something used in hay, and also trying to limit weeds. Without approved pesticides, hemp has to be grown organically. So while Houston's hemp has been doing well, he's still growing corn and soybeans, and still figuring things out.
I think I will probably be learning about hemp for the rest of my life, but that's what makes it pretty interesting.
So those with hemp experience say to start small, find a buyer, and don't bet the farm on it just yet. Madeline Beck, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration that focuses on America's farm and rural issues. Coming up on Main Street, we'll talk with retired UND philosophy professor George Frein about his portrayal of historic figures, including Mark Twain, and we'll hear a commentary from Mark Trahant. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. North Dakota's insurance department has fined Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Dakota $125,000 after a 16-month market conduct exam found it had improperly denied certain claims and failed to report some insurance fraud. Insurance Commissioner John Gottfried says the focus was on mental health and substance abuse claims. He says a lot of the problems came in disagreements over the level of treatment.
Your doctor says you need 10 days of inpatient treatment, and Blue Cross may come back and say, no, you need three. What we've asked Blue Cross to do in the coming while is to take a look at those claims and try to tip the needle in the favor of the member.
Gottfried says Blue Cross was very amenable to make changes, and already he's seeing some progress. He says the Blues have agreed to invest another $300,000 to address those issues.
Again, I'm optimistic that coming out of this exam, we're going to see in a new and improved Blue Cross that's going to, again, kind of maybe err on the side of the member for the time being, and which I think is probably long overdue.
Gottfried says while the exam has been wrapped up, the Blues have hired an outside audit firm to make sure to follow up the issues identified in the exam. North Dakota's Game and Fish Department wants to know more about your walleye catch on Sakakawea and Alkaline Lake. Prairie Public's Joshua Hinkmeyer has more on that story.
North Dakota's Game and Fish Department is tagging 3,000 walleye in Lake Sakakawea as part of a four-year study and 2,000 walleye in Alkaline Lake as part of a one-year study. Scott Gangle, Fisheries Management Section Leader, says the walleye are tagged with a metal band around the jaw with a unique number. He asks any angler that catches the tagged walleye to report the number to the Game and Fish by coming to a district office, calling them, or going to their website. Gangle says the department hopes to gain a lot of information through this study.
Out there. We can estimate mortality rates, how quickly they're dying. We can estimate natural mortality, which is due to natural causes, versus fishing mortality, which is due to angler harvest. We can actually estimate angler harvest, how many fish were taken out of a population.
Gangle says that if the fish are harvested by the anglers, the tag may be kept as a souvenir. Anglers can also give their contact information to the Game and Fish and receive a history of that fish, including how big it was and where it was when it was tagged. The Game and Fish has also put up signs around the two lakes with a scannable QR code, directing anglers to the website where they can report the tags. Reporting from Prairie Public, I'm Joshua Hinkmeyer.
And North Dakota producers have planted a lot less durum this year. The North Dakota Wheat Commission says durum acres fell to 750,000. That's the lowest since 2011. Wheat Commission Marketing Director Jim Peterson says it stands to reason.
Typically, producers need $1 to $1.50 a bushel premium to grow durum over spring wheat, primarily because of the quality risk. Durum has a much higher quality threshold to make milling quality, and that just hasn't been there the last couple of years.
Peterson says internationally, durum demand has also slowed.
And just from producers themselves, they have a fair amount of inventory sitting in the bin from last year's crop.
Peterson says Canada has, as he put it, flooded the U.S. market with durum, and says especially in northwestern North Dakota, spring wheat acres have increased durum's expense. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Mark Trahant is the editor of Indian Country Today, and we occasionally share his commentaries on Main Street. Today, Mark's subject is the detention centers on our nation's southern border, where asylum seekers are in custody awaiting legal proceedings. He says the government's own analysis indicates the human crisis at the border is worse than previously reported.
The government's own investigation shows that the treatment of migrants by border officials is, quote, a ticking time bomb that will only escalate. The government has had the report since May, but its contents were only released last week. The Inspector General for the Department of Homeland Security reviewed 5 Border Patrol facilities, 2 ports of entry in Texas, and observed serious overcrowding and prolonged detention of unaccompanied alien children, families, and single adults that require immediate attention. The report warned of potential riot conditions because of the treatment of those seeking asylum in the United States. Quote, "The current situation on the southern border represents an acute and worsening crisis." The report said, "Our immigration system is not equipped to accommodate a migration pattern like the one we are experiencing now." The Inspector General reinforced observations made by the Congressional Hispanic Caucus after a recent visit to the border. Representative Joaquin Castro, a Democrat from Texas, said not all of the women in detention had access to water, and some of them had not had a bath or shower in more than 2 weeks. Representative Castro secretly recorded his visit on a mobile phone. Members of Congress were told by the Border Patrol not to take pictures during their visit. Other members of Congress reported that the Border Patrol was dismissive of their oversight visit. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a Democrat from New York, wrote on Twitter that many of the children she spoke with spoke indigenous languages. Quote, "Some I met were budding trilingual, speaking Quiche, Spanish, and learning English." Meanwhile, a U.S. court judge issued a ruling that required the government to adjudicate asylum claims faster or release migrants from custody. "The purposes of immigration detention are simple and straightforward," the judge said, "to facilitate removal, if removal is deemed justified, and to prevent flight and harm to the community," wrote Judge Marsha Peckman from Seattle. The White House issued a statement calling the decision a war on the rule of law. The White House statement said, "The decision only incentivizes smugglers and traffickers, which will lead to the further overwhelming of our immigration system by illegal aliens." Congress, the Trump administration, indeed the country, remain deeply divided about what steps should be taken next. And so, the crisis on the border is only certain to grow worse. I'm Mark Trahant.
Next on Main Street, retired Professor George Frine talks about portraying Mark Twain.
Speaking French involves more than vocabulary and accent.
If you, you know, behave yourself and you're too polite and agreeing too much, looking for consensus, they find that dull.
Being liked is not that important to them. It's not being at fault that matters.
And while you're in Paris,
nightlife is not just something fun to do. I'd say it's a historical lesson.
Spend a lively hour in France on the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Wednesday at 8 here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined in studio by George Frine. He's a retired UND philosophy professor. I think you spent 29 years there, right?
Philosophy and religious studies.
All right.
We did both of them.
Well, now we're going to talk a little bit about history, American
history.
Author history.
And literature.
Because you are going to be portraying Mark Twain.
I am.
At an upcoming Prairie Talks at the Prairie Village Museum in Rugby. That will be this Sunday at 2 in the afternoon. It's free
right.
and open to the public.
Free as can be.
So let's talk about this guy. Did Mark Twain visit North Dakota?
Mark Twain took a train all the way across North Dakota. Major Pond, his organizer and promoter, tried to get him an appointment to speak in North Dakota. He wanted to use the new opera house, but he couldn't get it. So the Herald sent an interviewer on the train and interviewed him, and he talked about going across North Dakota, at that point coming across western Minnesota and seeing the oceans of wheat. He said, "I've been on the ocean, but never an ocean of wheat." He said, "I wrote to my friend Henry Rogers, the Standard Oil millionaire, and told him he ought to come out and see this ocean of wheat out
now,
here."
Now, this was in July of 1895?
July of 1895,
so
yes, just a few years
he
ago.
He went through North Dakota. He didn't stop.
He didn't stop. He stopped at Helena and Billings and on out to Seattle and Vancouver and then went on the rest of the tour to Australia, New Zealand, India, South Africa, then back up to London and came home.
Well, and literature and authors were the rock stars of the age, weren't they? Charles Dickens did this, too.
The headline in the Crookston paper, he lectured in Crookston, and the headline was, "He's here."
When did you start portraying Mark Twain?
Well, when Everett Albers said, "George, you did a very good Herman Melville. What should we do next?" I said, "The next literary period, and I want to be Mark Twain."
Ev Albers, we should remind our listeners, was the former director, the late director of the North Dakota Humanities Commission.
Council, yes, that's right.
And he created the Chautauqua program.
He did. He brought it back as a first person presentation. He said, "Nobody's going to come out and listen to a stuffy old college professor, but they'll come out and ask good questions of Mark Twain or Herman Melville or any number of other people." And he ran this show every summer We'd start off in Oklahoma, and 2 weeks in Oklahoma, Kansas, Nebraska, South Dakota, North Dakota. It was a great summer school for
me. I had the great pleasure of being in this in the Chautauqua in 1978.
Oh, my. And you did what?
I did the first sheriff of Moorhead, a guy by the name of James Blanchard. And as I mentioned to Ev, I thought at that time it was very ecumenical of North Dakota to support this Minnesota sheriff. But it was a big tent.
It was.
And it was a very interesting opportunity for a performer to impersonate somebody who was historically significant,
right,
about which there was a fair amount written,
right,
and you could learn about them. Clay Jenkinson was also somebody.
Thomas Jefferson and a lot of other people. And we were in Marmouth one time, and a man asked Clay a question. You said that your character was a fair to middling writer. How do you define a fair or middle? And I thought, boy, these are better questions than I get at UND, you know.
Well, how would you describe your approach to portraying somebody who actually lived?
Well, it's rather simple-minded. I start to read, and I read, and I read, and until something occurs to me. And then I begin to organize thoughts on a theme. I don't do what Hal Holbrook does, and that is give word-for-word paragraphs or pages from Mark Twain. But I imagine him speaking. In Rugby, he's going to speak on humor. He said he knows something about humor.
Yes, he did.
And so that's going to be my topic. And I have a dozen or more other Twain shows that illustrate his approach to life and literature.
Well, the Chautauquas typically run in a couple, like three pieces. One is a presentation where actually impersonate Twain, and others where you take questions in that
in character. Right.
And then the third is where you talk as George Frein, scholar.
That's right. And that, in that part, I can correct the mistakes that Twain made in the first part.
Well, give us a sense of George Frein as Mark Twain. How will you, you know, begin your discussion?
Well, I won't give away what I'm going to do on humor, but I do a program on his piloting days on the Mississippi, and I start out, steamboat a-coming, and then launch into his description of the sleepy town of Hannibal, Missouri, when a Negro drayman shouts out when he sees the boat, steamboat coming, and everybody pours out of houses and stores and watches this marvelous thing come dock. And there's a rush to get aboard, a rush to unload, and then 10 minutes more, and the steamboat is going down the river, and the town is dead again. He evokes a nice feeling for the town, and you get a sense of what it was like to live on the western frontier when that was the Mississippi.
Well, Mark Twain was born Samuel Clemens, and he was raised in Hannibal, Missouri.
Which
is a tourist attraction of
note
itself.
It is.
Why do you think he became such a literary titan?
Why did he become a literary titan? Because he couldn't make it as a preacher.
he tried steamboating.
He needed income. After when the Civil War came along, he couldn't steamboat anymore. At least he wasn't willing to stand at a pilot house all glass around. So he went home and then went out west. His brother had worked in Lincoln's campaign and got himself appointed secretary to the territorial governor out in Nevada. So he went out west and blew all his money saved from steamboating trying to make it big in silver mining, and he couldn't. And then he was tempted to become a preacher, he said, and I would have, because the regular preachers, you know, are on vacation 6 days a week. I'd have been a good one, except I didn't have any religion, so it wouldn't work.
He seemed to have a way to talk to people, though, that like Will Rogers did a generation later.
Exactly so. He said on his worldwide tour that began here in North Dakota that he talked to presidents and kings and maharajas and all kinds. But he said, I like common people. He said, those are the ones I don't try to write to improve the better classes. I write for ordinary people. He said, great literature is like wine. Mine is just like water. But everybody drinks water.
Well, he was an adventurer too, though. He took a famous trip to Egypt and to the Middle East, where it was actually dangerous at the time. I think there was a plague or something.
Well, he went to Europe and the Holy Land on the Quaker City, one of the first tourist ships across the Atlantic. Henry Ward Beecher's parishioners from Brooklyn, New York, were going. And he applied to go as the Reverend Mark Twain, but he wasn't taken on. But he was hired to write about that trip, and that produced his first book, the first real book. He didn't count the Jumping Frog stories as a real book, Innocents Abroad. And he made fun of the innocents abroad who went to galleries and looked at the art, but they wanted to know the right pictures to look at, according to the standards back home.
Now, back to the Chautauqua kind of appearance that you'll be recreating at Prairie Talks at the Prairie Village Museum in Rugby on Sunday. There is that presentation you do where you impersonate Mark Twain. Right. Then the audience asks you questions, yes, and you answer in the persona of Twain. Give us a sense of how that works.
A frequent question is, because I'm dressed up in a white suit and I have a white wig on, we have both same color of hair, but I don't have as much as he did, even in old age. So they will often ask, why do you wear white? And I say, it is the uniform of the American Society of Purity and Perfection, of which I am the only member eligible. And that gives, I think, some sense. He used to parade down Fifth Avenue when church was letting out in New York City so people could see him and pay attention to him, because he was publishing his autobiography at that time.
Well, he wrote these great novels, of course.
He
and,
did.
And Huckleberry Finn is still remembered as one that, that was filled with what was, frankly, some pretty provocative social commentary for the time.
It was. It was an attack not on slavery, because that was 20 years over, but on Gilded Age racism. And he uses the N-word frequently. He puts it on the lips of Pap, who's Huck's dad, and he's
a ne'er
drunk.
Do well, yeah.
Yeah, he at least a ne'er do well. And he goes after people he calls by the N-word, and he describes one he saw on the street who wouldn't have given him the road if he didn't shove him out of the way. And the worst thing is, that man is dressed better than I am, better than anybody. And they tell me when he's back home in Illinois, he can vote. And you see, you hear the maliciousness of Pap's approach. And it's an attempt at white supremacy on Pap's part.
And the author, using literature,
yes,
that engages people,
it does,
to deliver a message that resonates today.
Oh, I think so. There were people writing on the race issue at the time. None of them you remember. None of them are still read. But Twain is. And his work is still controversial. And still, I remember talking to a man after a program once, and he said, you know, that word hell that Huck uses and the N-word that he uses, I don't remember those when I read it as a boy. Adventures of Huckleberry Finn is not a boy's story.
No.
It's about a boy, but it's an adult story. Toni Morrison said she reads it every year and finds something new in it every year.
Now, you have not just done Mark Twain. You've done other impersonations. You mentioned Herman Melville, the author,
yes,
of Moby Dick.
Moby Dick, yes. Wonderful. You know, when I finished doing Melville and everyone wanted me to go on to do Twain, I thought, well, he's not going to be up to Melville, but he is. And last year I was in Rugby for Prairie Talks, and there I did the great war novelist Remarque. Eric Maria Remarque, who wrote All Quiet on the Western Front. And, of course, the Twain program would be very different than that one. There weren't too many laughs in that one, exceedingly serious. I mean, the soldiers laughed.
Well, Remarque was writing about something he experienced. He was in World War
I. He was in World War I, that's right, and knew it as a soldier, as a wounded man, as a decorated man, and as a man who hated the idea of war.
And was not popular with the Nazis. He left Germany during before World War II.
He loved race cars, and he took his racing car out of Berlin the night Hitler came to power. And he knew they were coming for him because a friend had tipped him off. He just barely made it to Switzerland.
So these are important people, important writers.
They are.
What makes a writer like a Mark Twain or an Eric Maria Remarque or Herman Melville last as long as they do?
Well, I think they last because they get it just right when they're talking about something important to human nature. And that's why humanities is a promoter of this kind of presentation, because it does philosophy in first person, in real experience, and in the communication of that experience to other people. And Everett was absolutely right. I could go out there and give a wonderful third-person lecture, and they wouldn't ask a professor questions. They have no inhibition about asking Twain a question or Melville a question because he's touched them. In a way in which I think a prof.
So you do this, you were teaching at UND at the time. So did you bring some of this to the classroom?
Well, mostly it came to the classroom. I taught some biblical studies course, and I would hear Mark Twain talking inside my head, and no, I can't talk about that in the lecture. But as I said to the students one day, I said, you know, I've got to go out and do this Chautauqua across the Great Plains this summer. And I'll bet I'll never get that hateful question that I get all the time from you guys. I said, what's that? Is this going to be on the exam?
Oh, yes.
It's just learning for learning's sake. It's just delightful.
But one thing that is likely to happen at a Chautauqua when you're doing the question and answer with the mm-hmm. audience after in character is that they'll ask you to respond to a current event as the character.
They will. And I have a couple of different ways of putting that off until I break character, and then we can talk about it. I had a woman colleague once who said, you know, we can't talk about abortion in 1800, but we can today. So when she would be asked that question, she would say, let's wait just a minute, and I'll come back to that. Don't let me forget. So there are ways to – an anachronistic question, maybe the best question of the night, but we need to take it out of character.
George Frein is a retired UND philosophy professor, and he will be portraying Mark Twain on humor at Prairie Talks at the Prairie Village Museum in Rugby, North Dakota, on Sunday at 2 o'clock. It's free and open to the public. He'll be in Velva on Monday from 3 to 5, and in Oaks, North Dakota, on Thursday the 18th at 7 p.m. George, thanks for dropping by Main Street today.
Thank you. It's great to be on Main Street.
And reminding us about the Chautauqua and about these great authors.
Thank you.
Dakota Datebook is next.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
Next time on The Pulse, these days pretty much everybody calls addiction a disease.
The disease of addiction.
The disease of addiction.
The ugly disease of addiction.
More specifically, we call it a brain disease. But does that send the wrong message?
Oh, they have a brain disease. Get those zombies away from me. We better lock them up because they can't control their behavior.
We'll explore what we call things and why it matters.
Thursday at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 9th. The very best tall tale about North Dakota's gigantic mosquitoes came from Martin N. Johnson, a congressman and storyteller. Johnson often repeated his mosquito tall tale, a perfect example of exaggeration and unabashed overstatement. It goes like this. In 1883, I was breaking a section of farmland in North Dakota. The mosquitoes made me so wretched that in despair I crawled under an enormous iron cooking kettle. In my fancied security, I felt a prickling sensation in my left shoulder. An enormous mosquito had actually bored its way through that iron kettle. Taking a small sledgehammer from my pocket, I managed to bend his stinger in such a way that it could not be withdrawn. The fuss the mosquito made attracted 1,000 of his brethren, a cloud of mosquitoes, and before I knew it, there were stingers coming through the kettle in every direction. One by one, the mosquitoes bored their stingers through the kettle until the inside bristled with their stingers. I hammered each stinger until it bent so they could not withdraw. I hammered the stingers as fast as I could. When, after an hour or so of this labor, just as I was exhausted with hammering, the mosquitoes suddenly tired of this attack and, being unable to extricate themselves, lifted the kettle and flew away with it. Upon the truth of his story being questioned, Johnson would say, "Well, were you ever out on the North Dakota prairie in 1883? When the listener replied no, Johnson would say, "Well, then you ought to have faith in a man who was." It was on this date in 1899 that the Brooklyn Daily Eagle published a variation of Johnson's tall tale, proclaiming that North Dakota's mosquitoes were bigger and stronger than the New Jersey breed, the worst of all American mosquitoes. Martin Nelson Johnson, born in Wisconsin in 1850, came to Petersburg, North Dakota in 1883. In 1880, he was elected to Congress and served 8 years. In 1908, he was elected to the Senate. 11 years later, in 1909, he died very suddenly. Remembered as an entertaining storyteller, newspapers commented on his famous mosquito story by calling it the tallest lie of the season. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Steve Hoffbeck. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
The National African American Gun Association is a black alternative to the NRA.
Black folks and guns usually get a negative stereotype reaction, like, what is that guy doing with a gun?
Now members are debating whether the group should get more political.
When others see that we're for protection, I think maybe it would more than likely increase our numbers.
That story and Noel King at the border on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Wednesday on Main Street, in the midst of a very green July, we'll talk with horticulturist Ron Smith about the growing season ahead. During the live afternoon show, Ron will take your lawn and garden questions, and you can call us during the show toll-free. If you want to take that number down, you can do it right now, 888-755-6377. We'll repeat it quite a few times during our show on Wednesday. But you can email your question right now to mainstreet@prairiepublic.org. We hope you enjoy the rest of your day.